DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Spectrum. I'm Connor Dillon.
Hello. My name is Dickie Starshine. I want to tell you something. Imagine you could be all over the world. Imagine you could be whatever you want to be. Imagine you could meet whoever you want to meet. And imagine you could buy anything at every time.
But Dickie, that's not possible. How could it happen? This must be a dream.
No, this is not a dream. This can be reality.
Oh boy, okay, well, we are going to dedicate this week's Spectrum to a technology that has changed our day-to-day lives probably more than any other. And that song back there might have just given it away. That is the internet. And today we are going to meet one of the co-creators of it. His official job title today is Chief Internet Evangelist at Google. Think about that for a second. I'm going to say it again. Chief Internet Evangelist at Google. And he's also considered one of the, quote, fathers of the internet. But in real life, he's really just plain old Vinton Cerf. He has spent the past 50-odd years changing and shaping our world through science and technology.
We knew that we didn't know what new technologies would come along in future years, and we wanted to make our design future-proof.
Now, Vinton Cerf is not a Nobel laureate, but this year he was invited to the Lindau Nobel Laureate meeting to hold its inaugural Heidelberg lecture on the origins and evolution of the internet. My colleague, Zulfikar Abani, had a chance to speak with Cerf in Lindau, and here's Zulfikar with more.
You may never have heard of Vinton Cerf, and it really doesn't matter whether you have or you haven't. But your life and his will have intersected at least a few times since you got up this morning, possibly even while you were asleep and a moment ago when you downloaded this program. That's because Vinton, or more commonly Vint Cerf, as one of the fathers of the internet way back in the 1960s and 70s, developed the all-important TCP/IP protocols. They also may not mean much to you, and why should they? But just for the record, TCP/IP stands for Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol, and together they help facilitate the internet's so-called open architecture. Basically, this means we should be able to continue to expand the internet until it gets so big it eats us all up. Today, as Google's chief internet evangelist, Cerf's official Google profile says he contributes to global policy development and continued spread of the internet. Put like that, it sounds a bit like a disease, doesn't it? But to Cerf, the internet and technological advance is all good. He is a phenomenal evangelist. He is very convinced of himself, and who wouldn't be, having changed so many people's lives the way Cerf has? There's a good chance he never dreamt of that job title, though, when he was growing up in post-war America. I imagine there aren't many kids at school today who tell their teachers and parents they want to become an internet evangelist either. And this is a key point. The internet today isn't what it set out to be, really. It was conceived in such a way as to allow for any and every possible development, but originally the idea was a little more humble. All they wanted to do was create a network of computers to share information between researchers in different locations because they couldn't afford to keep buying new computers to store all the same data locally. It was the start of what we take for granted today. All the way up to cloud storage, web apps, encryption, surveillance, Bitcoin, networked industry, artificial intelligence, big data, mobile gaming and esports, self-driving cars, augmented reality, and trolls on Twitter, but not necessarily in that order. Oh, just one other thing before we get going, to make sure we're talking about the same thing. The internet is not the same as the World Wide Web. Or to be precise, the web is not the net. The internet, you see, is the basic network infrastructure that allows data transfers from point A to B and every spy agency and hacker in between. The World Wide Web, meanwhile, that's all the websites, the social media, e-shops, etc., that sits on top of the net. It has its own protocols, things like HTML, URLs and HTTP, the code that dictates how we see and experience the sites we visit. But it's not the internet. The internet goes deeper. So, let's hear how it all started from one of the fathers of the internet, Vint Cerf. In a moment, he'll mention what's called packet switching. Essentially, it's a way of transmitting data, say a message, in a number of smaller parts which are reassembled at their destination. It replaced circuit switching, but don't worry about that for now.
Hi, this is Vint Cerf, speaking to you from the bowels of Lindau.
When you were thinking about what has become the internet, where did it start? I mean, what were you thinking? What was the idea? I want to do what?
Okay, so first of all, many people misunderstand that somehow the internet was this brilliant conception of today's world 40 years ago, and this would be incorrect. This turned out to be a problem that was placed in front of Bob Kahn and me. And Bob, to give him credit, is the one who posed the problem in the first place. We and others worked on something called ARPANET, which is a packet switching, an experiment, really, in large-scale packet switching technology. The packet switching notion had been thought of even before that in the early 1960s. So we thought this would be a way of doing computer-to-computer communication. And we were particularly interested in getting computers of different brands to communicate with each other, because historically only the same brand machines could talk to each other, like IBM's SNA and so on. So our first task was how to get different kinds of computers to talk to each other. And you might say, well, why would we do that? And in the ARPANET case, it was driven by a financial problem. The universities that were supported by DARPA to do research in computer science and artificial intelligence kept asking for new computing equipment, and ARPA said, we can't buy new computers for every campus every year. You'll have to share resources. So that network was a resource-sharing system, and the interconnections were experimentally based on packet switching.
In 1965, Thomas Merrill and Lawrence Roberts connected a TX2 computer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to a Q32 in California on a low-speed dial-up telephone line to create the first wide-area computer network. And soon after that came the ARPANET, the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network. So by 1969, four host computers were connected to the ARPANET, starting at UCLA and Stanford Research Institute, and later at UC Santa Barbara and the University of Utah.
After it was demonstrated that that worked from 1969 to 1973, Bob Kahn joined DARPA, and he realized that computers could be used for command and control, and there was a lot of thinking along those lines. Douglas Engelbart at SRI International had built a system called the Online System, and J.C.R. Licklider, who was a psychologist at MIT, who opened the Information Processing Techniques Office at ARPA, realized that computers could be used for other than numerical computation. And so the idea of using computers in command and control becomes one of the driving forces in all this. At this point, Bob Kahn realizes that if we're serious about using computers in command and control, they're probably going to have to be on board mobile vehicles and aircraft and ships at sea. The packet switching experiment, which was demonstrated so successfully, used dedicated telephone lines to connect fixed computers together. And that doesn't work with the, you know, tanks will run over the wires and the ships won't ever, you know, get all tangled up in the wires. So we had to use mobile radio and satellite. So Bob began developing a mobile radio system a data communication system. One of his predecessors at ARPA, Larry Roberts, had already started looking at the possibility of shared satellite channels, which would serve as ships at sea, ship to ship, and ship to shore. So by the time Bob showed up in my lab at Stanford, he's saying, we have a problem. What's the problem? He said, well, if we have these different kinds of packet switch nets, how do we hook them all together so they all look like one thing? That was the internet problem. How do I interconnect networks? And so it wasn't this grand vision of everyone running around with mobiles and doing smartphones. It was the fundamental problem of designing an infrastructure that had certain properties. For example, insensitivity to the kind of communication or transmission technology that was used.
Dickie Starshine, you did not create the internet. It was created, or at least in part, by Vint Cerf. So let's head back to him right now via DW's Zulfikar Abani, who has more on the small-scale network that would ultimately lead to today's internet.
Now, listen carefully, because this is where visionary ideas come into play. The designers of this network had to see what wasn't there. In fact, they had to try to not see what might be there in the future so as not to limit the internet's existence by other earlier ideas. That's forward thinking on steroids.
So we wanted to design a system that didn't care whether the packets it was supporting were going over an optical fiber, a satellite link, or a mobile radio channel. And we knew that we didn't know what new technologies would come along in future years, and we wanted to make our design future-proof with regard to new transmission technology, and I think we succeeded at that. The second thing that we realized is that we didn't know what all the applications were going to be, and we did not want to design an application-specific network. And so the challenge there was to make the network insensitive to the application, as well as being insensitive to the underlying transmission system. And so we designed the Internet protocol layer to know nothing about the applications. The consequence of that has been dramatic, because that meant that when somebody wanted to invent a new application, they didn't change the network, because the network didn't know anything about the applications. They only had to change the software and the computers at the edges of the net to interpret the data that the packets were carrying. And so this stupid network turned out to be a brilliant architectural choice.
I like that. Vint Cerf calling the internet a stupid network, as opposed, of course, to the so-called smart networks we have today, which apparently know everything all the time. But future-proofing is a big ask, particularly when you don't know what it is you're trying to protect against shocks from the future. They didn't really know what the internet would become, so they had to future-proof a thing that wasn't fully defined against things they couldn't fully foresee. It's mind-boggling, isn't it? Just as mind-boggling as some of the terminology Cerf uses in this next segment, in which we talk a little bit more about future-proofing and expanding the network right into space with the interplanetary internet. So, shall I run through a few definitions? It'll give me a chance to learn a thing or two as well. Here goes. He'll mention, for instance, IPv4 and IPv6. This is the Internet Protocol versions 4 and 6, one of the central protocols on the Internet. Version 6 is the most recent. Each computer or device on the Internet is assigned an IP address to identify and locate it. Then there are routing protocols, which specify how routers talk to one another. One such protocol Surf will mention is the Border Gateway Protocol, or BGP. Now, BGP can now carry routes or routes for multicast, that's group communication to you and me, IPv6, virtual private networks, and a variety of other data, according to Cisco, which is a company that sells network equipment. You have a router at home, by the way. It's how you access the internet and the World Wide Web, basically. Then you might like to know about store and forward. It's pretty self-explanatory, really. Imagine you want to send a message over a long, long distance, say from Jupiter to Earth. Well, much the same as flying long haul, Frankfurt to Auckland, you'd make a few stopovers. You send your message to an intermediate location where it is stored and then forwarded to another intermediary or its final destination. Now, flow control. This is how we manage the flow of data between computers or devices on the internet or nodes on a network, and the idea is to make the flow as efficient as possible. And last but by no means least is DNS lookup. Well, DNS allows humans to remember internet addresses, which are actually long strings of numbers, and the lookup bit is similar to our looking up a telephone number in an old school phone book. Well, there are a few more, but that should get us through the story for now. So here is Vince Cerf again on the challenges of future-proofing the internet, starting with a question from me. Talking about future-proofing, it's one of these things that people do try to get right time and again, but in the sense what you did was so fundamental that it can only be one way, in a sense. So it's really hardwired in there, isn't it? But is there a problem with that, that you will come against a point where you can no longer expand the network because there are some things that nobody can see? Or are we only going to expand within the framework that you've set?
Well, I can give you some examples of our ability to break through some of those barriers. For example, we thought that we only needed 4.3 billion terminations on the network, and that's what the IP version 4 allowed for with a 32-bit address space. By the mid-1990s or early 1990s, it was clear we were going to run out of that address space. Well, the response of the Internet Engineering Task Force was to develop what's called IP version 6 with 128 bits of address. We're maybe 10% penetrated now after 20 years, and the technology and the architecture accommodated that kind of change. There have been a number of other explorations. The early routing protocols were very primitive and didn't scale very well, and so we have altered those routing protocols over time. The Border Gateway Protocol, for example, has gone through four iterations. It's kind of overloaded, functionally speaking, right now, but it's still serving the network reasonably well. In terms of applications, in the mid-70s and the early 80s, we were experimenting with packetized voice and video. We didn't have a lot of capacity to carry it, but we could demonstrate that packetized voice and video worked. Of course, now once it works, then you want to use more of it, and then you run out of bandwidth. And so as the network speeds went up, as new optical fiber came along, as we managed to operate at higher and higher frequencies, the capacity of the network to carry video and voice increased. So, in fact, even though we were demonstrating it in small quantities in the 70s and 80s, today, 2016, we're carrying enormous amounts of real-time video and real-time voice. New technologies come along to allow the network to expand along some of the parametric space that the design permits. There may be, however, things that the network doesn't do very well. For example, at the moment, it's not a very good system for broadcasting the same content everywhere. For example, in a satellite system, a synchronous satellite could be broadcasting large amounts of IP packets to a large number of receivers simultaneously so that you don't have to send the information individually to each one. We tried to do multicast inside the store and forward network, and that turned out to have enough overhead that it was not very interesting. And as the data rates of the net went up, we started just using point-to-point transfers, even for video. But this notion of doing broadcast IP for certain applications is not only feasible, but I think it makes a lot of economic sense. So someday somebody will figure that out, and we'll see satellite-based systems doing broadcast. The network still accommodates a lot of evolution. And I guess the final thing to say on this whole point of adaptability is that because it's a layered protocol architecture, we have been very friendly to new protocols coming along within any particular layer. The only place where it's really tough is the IP layer, which is sort of the narrow waist of the all the protocol stacks. And even there, we've been able to accommodate V4 and V6 running concurrently in the system without having the system collapse. So I'm not prepared to argue that the network doesn't have the ability to continue to expand in functional ways as well as capacity. It doesn't mean that there won't be something better coming. I just don't know what it is.
Well, I mean, you have also worked on the interplanet, you know. So in terms of expanding this network, it's not only here on Earth, we're in space. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that, how that's going to work, because you're already using satellites and objects in space, the International Space Station, etc.
So, well, here's a very good case where, in fact, the existing Internet architecture did not work. It did not expand to handle the parametric space that we have in interplanetary communication. The problem here is that the speed of light is too slow, and the distances between the planets are literally astronomical. So between Earth and Mars, for example, when we're closest in our orbits, it's 3.5 minutes one way at the speed of light and 7 minutes round trip time. And when we're farthest apart, it's 20 minutes one way, 40 minutes round trip. Flow control in the TCP protocol does not work with a 40-minute round trip time. It just doesn't. So we have another problem, and that's planetary rotation. When you're talking to something on the surface of the planet and the planet rotates, eventually you can't talk to it because you're out of line of sight. And so you have to wait until it gets back around the other way. And the same is true of some satellites that are in orbit. They go behind the planet. You can't talk to them. So it's a disrupted and variable delay environment. It gets worse. Some of the upper layers of the Internet protocol use domain names, which are all familiar with that, using the World Wide Web. And domain names have to be translated into IP addresses before the lower-level protocols can deliver packets to that destination. Well, that's all fine, but now let's imagine you're on Mars and you're trying to get to a website on Earth. Okay, so the first thing you have to do is go to the domain name system in order to get back an IP address in order to open up a TCP connection to get to the website. Well, the trouble is, if it takes 40 minutes to find out the answer to the domain name lookup, by that time, maybe the IP address has changed because it's a mobile target and it's moved from one part of the Internet to another. So the DNS lookups don't look like they work very well. It gets worse. Network management becomes a big problem. In the terrestrial Internet, relatively low latency is helpful. So if you send a ping packet, that's actually a formal term, to some destination, you get a response back in a few hundred milliseconds. You can verify the status of that thing. We use that a lot in network management, you know, to say, are you alive, you know, or what's your current state, or please tell me, you know, whether your buffers are overflowing.
Or checking the speed of your home network, you use pings.
Yes, exactly, all the time. So pinging works great in a low latency environment, but in this interplanetary environment, we don't even know when the response is likely to come back, especially if it's a store and forward interplanetary network. Because the links may not always be up because of planetary rotation or battery power problems or interference or other kinds of infirmities. The result is that a network architecture which has uncertain and possibly very large delay built into it. So the protocols of the interplanetary system are quite different from the terrestrial Internet. They will run on top of the terrestrial Internet protocols. So if I wanted to run end-to-end from Jupiter all the way back to Earth, I could run interplanetary to Earth and then continue to run the interplanetary protocols on the low-latency Internet protocols, just embedded on top. So now we're back to another layered structure again. So there we really had to redefine what the protocols are, how they work, how addressing worked. In this case, you'd like to get to the right planet before you try to figure out where you're going on that planet. And so we have a two-layer addressing structure in the interplanetary system, which was not necessary in the purely terrestrial network.
Crazy stuff, isn't it? But to paraphrase something Cerf said later in the interview, it is what it is. Actually, when I asked Cerf how far off we were from real-time communication between Jupiter and Earth, he said, "My use of the term real-time was fanciful at best. The speed of light is what it is," he told me. But what about wormholes and time travel? And who would have thought in the 1960s that only 50-odd years later we would be walking down a street in one country, video chatting with people in another? Surely someone would have said, "Hey, Surf, the speed of light is what it is, mate."
We're not going to have real-time interactive communication between Jupiter and Earth. It just isn't going to happen. It's, you know, minutes to hours. That's why the interplanetary design took so much effort, because we didn't have real-time communication at all. We already have an interplanetary network in operation now. It's between Earth, Mars, and the International Space Station. We've been encouraging the people who are making spacecraft for exploration to consider stockpiling those protocols as part of their standard off-the-shelf capability. So when NASA is designing new missions, they can use constellations of spacecraft that can communicate with each other locally, as opposed to going all the way back to Earth, which is classically what's happened. We have this deep space network that was built in 1964, consisting of three 70-meter dishes, and it's classic that you have point-to-point radio links going from wherever the spacecraft is back to Earth. And the original plan for Mars exploration had always been spacecraft landing on the surface of Mars, for example, or possibly in orbit, transmitting data directly back to the deep space net. We tried to do that with the 2004 rovers that landed and discovered that the radios were overheating. The consequence of this was to rethink the ways of getting information back to Earth. And so we reprogrammed the orbiters, which had originally been used to map the surface of Mars to figure out where we should put the rovers. Those were reprogrammed, as were the rovers, so that they would receive data from the rovers while they were in orbit and then hang on to the data until they get to the point in their orbit where they can transmit back to Earth. So that's a store and forward network, which is what packet switching is all about. So we had an instance of a store and forward network being used to gather all the data coming back from Mars since 2004. And we've now extended that to include the International Space Station. By standardizing the protocols, our expectation is that as new missions get launched, like the one to the Juno mission to Jupiter, that once the spacecraft has completed its primary function, it can become part of an interplanetary backbone. So as we launch more and more missions around our solar system, we'll be able to literally accrete an interplanetary backbone mission by mission, supporting future manned and robotic space exploration.
Vince Cerf, one of the fathers of the internet, speaking to me there at the 2016 Lindau Nobel Laureate meeting. For a person who has influenced so much, it is amazing that he continues to forge ahead. He's also part of a UK-based team currently working on designing an unmanned interstellar space probe. It's as if the internet wasn't enough. But then they do say that a scientist is a scientist for life.
Welcome to the internet. The old world is dead. Welcome to the internet. We never go to bed. Welcome to the internet. The old world is dead. Welcome to the internet. The future's ahead.
And that was Zulfikar Abani there, speaking to Vint Cerf, one of the co-founders of the internet and one of the fathers of the TCP/IP protocol, and frankly, one of the reasons you can surf the web today. That brings us to the end of this week's Spectrum. Remember, you can keep up to date with all things SciTech on our website at dw.com/science, and on Twitter, we're at dw_SciTech, where we tweet all sorts of fun stuff. Thanks to our technician today, Thomas Schmidt, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another packed edition of Spectrum. I'm Connor Dillon. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead.
Internet.